Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with biographer Jeffrey Ward about his new book. Its subject, The Best Hated Man in America, who also happens to be Jeff Ward's ancestor.
He was an enormous swindler. He brought on or helped bring on a Wall Street crash.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The Times' Pulitzer Prize-winning critic Holland Cotter takes us inside the forgotten world of painter Thomas Hart Benton.
He's a difficult guy, but he's part of the story. I think you have to pull him in and recognize that he was a formative influence in his time.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Jeffrey Ward is one of America's most distinguished, honored, and popular historians, and he's got an important and most unusual new book. It's called A Disposition to Be Rich, How a Small-Time Pastor's Son Ruined an American President, Brought on a Wall Street Crash, and Made Himself the Best Hated Man in the United States. It's reviewed for us by T.J. Stiles, who says that Jeffrey Ward has written an elegant new biography and applies his characteristic scrupulousness and narrative skill. Vivid living people swarm the pages. I'm delighted that Jeff Ward is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So the best hated man in America shares a surname with you. Who was he?
He was Ferdinand Ward, and he was the Bernie Madoff of the late 19th century. He was the inventor, not the inventor, but certainly one of the early developers of the Ponzi scheme. And he was an enormous swindler. He brought on or helped bring on a Wall Street crash, and he happens to be my great-grandfather.
Now, let's start with some of his misdeeds and then get to your connection with him. What he's most famous for, of course, really is the bankrupting, the ruination of a great American hero.
He lured U.S. Grant into partnership with him. Grant had been president. He'd been a very, very fine general, a reasonably good president. And he was a fool on Wall Street, and my great-grandfather lured him in with promises of huge profits and then used his name to raise money from hundreds of gullible investors.
And how was it exposed?
Well, he ruined a bank. One of his partners was a venal banker, something we no longer have, of course, in America, who basically let him at the deposits. The bank eventually crashed.
Which bank was this?
It was the National Marine Bank, run by a otherwise well-respected banker named James D. Fish. And Fish was an honest man who got taken in by my great-grandfather, who became his partner, and gradually became, as he made more and more money, became more and more crooked, and eventually Ferdinand had access basically to everything in the vault.
And how did he get to Ulysses Grant? What was the connection that brought him there?
I'm not sure serendipity is the right word. Bad luck is the right word. Ferdinand had a perfectly nice brother who was a mining engineer who got to know Grant's eldest and probably not brightest son, Ulysses Jr., Buck, his name was, and they became partners. And Ferdinand gave him so much talk, at least, of the great money they were making, that he convinced his father to join the firm as a favor to his father. It was a fatal mistake because from the beginning it was a crooked firm.
And did Grant need the money? He had retired. Yes. He'd served two terms.
Yeah, there were no pensions for presidents, ex-presidents then, and he had very little money. And his option was either to move to Galena, Illinois, his hometown, where the proud citizens had built him a house, but he was now used to much fancier things than Galena, or to move to New York. And his wife wanted him to move to New York. And all of his friends were very, very rich. Everybody seemed to be making money. This really was the Gilded Age.
Right.
And he thought, I want some of that too. And then, as if by a miracle, my great-grandfather appeared promising him endless riches.
Well, one of Grant's great contemporaries, Mark Twain, also fell prey to this kind of Gilded Age boondoggle, didn't he? And
he did. He did fall prey to it, but he redeemed it with this, because Grant, in order to pay off his debts and support his family, wrote the memoirs that he had refused to write. And Mark Twain published those, and my brother likes to say, and he's correct, that that's my family's great contribution to American literature, is U.S. Grant's memoirs.
The greatest.
They are the greatest
of all the memoirs.
Yes, they're interesting. They're the greatest memoirs by a president, but they don't touch his presidency.
No, it's about the war.
It's about the war.
But it's a work of genius,
absolute genius, and great American language. Wonderful book.
Now let's go back to the family. You grew up with this story, didn't you? You're a renowned historian now, but growing up, you must have heard about Ferdinand Ward.
Yeah, I heard about him off and on. My grandfather, his son, was the head of the art department at Oberlin College, and I went to Oberlin. And we used to hear the stories that his father was scandalous and so on, but never much detail. His father did kidnap him when he was a little boy, and we heard that story quite often because it was a good kid's story. But when I was in college, he one day called me up to his study, and he brought out a box. And in it were letters tied up with red ribbon. It was basically the contents of his father's trunk at Sing Sing. And that got me interested, because they're letters from his wife and letters about his legal case and so on. That got me started. And there are letters, notes to the jailer to get, please put me in a better cell. I'll make you happy if you do.
How long was he in prison? Did he die in prison?
No, he didn't die in prison. He was sentenced to several years for grand larceny, got out because of good behavior, and promptly kidnapped his son.
Now explain.
That's the kind of guy he was.
Yes, explain, first of all, how you kidnap your son, and then why.
His wife had died while he was in prison. She had a small amount of money of her own. He had already stolen everything else that she had. And she was smart enough, before she died, to write a will leaving her estate, such as it was, jewelry and so on, to her son. The son was being raised by her brother when Ferdinand was in prison. So he got out and said he wanted his son. What he really wanted was the money. They were living in Connecticut. He hired two thugs to steal him from the little town of Thompson, where he was being raised. And they rode across the Massachusetts line in a buggy, but they had been spotted. And a posse of Connecticut farmers with pistols on horseback chased the buggy, which meant that they came back to the place where he was to pick up his son in Massachusetts, and he was getting a shave. Because he wanted to look good when he reclaimed his boy. And he watched this cavalcade of pounding horses run past the barbershop, and he missed his chance. And the courts sensibly did the right thing. In those days, there was no Lindbergh law. So if you were a father and you could get a hold of your child and get across a state line, nobody from the other state could stop you.
When you are looking at a forebear, an ancestor who did these things— And that also means you're researching your own family history. Mm-hmm. Did you find out much about the Wards that you didn't know before?
Yeah, I did. They were the founders, or among the founders, of Rochester, New York. The swindler's father and mother were missionaries to South India, self-righteous beyond measure and quarrelsome. They were really perfectly awful people, I'm sorry to say. And this kid, who I think was a sociopath, I think the wiring was probably wrong from when he was small, but the particular kind of craziness that he developed, I think, had a lot to do with that. They saw themselves as perpetual victims. Other members of the family were wealthy. That was because they were virtuous and the others were not, and so on. And he saw himself as a victim. He never accepted guilt for anything. Nothing he did was his fault. It was always other people's fault. If they hadn't been venal, his deal wouldn't have worked. And therefore, they were venal, and he was just the innocent source of their pipe dreams.
But he must also have been persuasive,
absolutely,
charming? Did he have the social graces? Where did he learn all this?
He was a clergyman's son, and he was a small man with a big Adam's apple, an absolutely unprepossessing person. Charming, had very fine sort of small, he never swore in public, and he had a great big picture of Jesus on the wall of his wonderful Brooklyn brownstone, just so that people would come in and think, this is a guy you can leave your money with. And he took it all.
When you look at your own work, the kind of thing you as a major historian do, you have to kind of inhabit other people's lives. Their experiences have to become yours. Did you identify with him at all? Did you find aspects of him?
No. I've written three books on Franklin Roosevelt. And Roosevelt often lied about himself in order to push himself when he was young. And you deal with that because there's a lot more to him. So you can live with that perfectly happily and you could identify with him. This guy is a thoroughgoing sociopath. And I still, when I think about him, I sort of want to take a shower. I mean, at any point, he makes the morally wrong decision from Monday through Sunday.
Were there any sources, documents, or relatives that were hard for you to get to or uncover? Or is this just a matter of doing the historian's job, following the paper trails, or because you're writing about a family member, were there different avenues that you take as a
story? I was very lucky early on. I met a nephew of his who had been a judge in the Cairo International Court for 50 years. And he had about 1,500 family letters, a few of them from him, but many of them about him, that he had kept on a veranda in Cairo for a half a century. I found out about them. I managed to approach him. He wasn't at all sure that he wanted anyone to write about this swindler, and we had quite a long correspondence about that. And finally, the letters were delivered to me, and there are the bulk of this book.
Jeff, you say the best hated man in America. How famous was Ward, Ferdinand Ward, at his peak?
Oh, he was hugely famous. He was called the best hated man in America, and he liked being called the best hated man in America. I mean, he loved the notoriety of it. He loved to talk to the newspapers about himself. So there's endless miles and miles of columns in the Times and other papers about him. He was a sort of, you know, if you wanted to talk about a swindler in those for the next 20 years, you would say he was a sort of a Ferdinand Ward, or he was almost as bad as Ferdinand Ward.
And as you say, kind of a Bernard Madoff character.
Yeah.
Did he develop any aspect of the Ponzi scheme we hadn't seen before?
No, but he preceded the Ponzi scheme. And my brother thinks it should be called the Ward scheme.
Well, maybe history will give him his due. Thanks so much, Jeff Ward. That's Jeffrey Ward, whose new book, A Disposition to Be Rich, is reviewed in this week's book review. So Julie Page One Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam. What an introduction.
Well, tell us about the story you've got on the front of the paper.
As you know, YA fiction is the biggest, fastest growing category in publishing these days. And it looks like publishers are looking to the classics for more material. And what they've done, what several publishers have done, is take books like Emma and Wuthering Heights, some classics by Jane Austen, the Bronte sisters, and repackage them with jackets that look more like YA books.
What does that mean exactly? Are they sexier?
They're sexier. They're more modern. They're more colorful. You know, when you think of the more traditional covers, when you go into a Barnes & Noble or look at your shelf and see all of the classics, you think of, you know, the oil painting of the woman with the, you know, lacy dress that goes up to, you know, her collar, and she looks very serious and dour. And when you look at these new versions of the books, you see, you know, really bright colors. You see on one version of Romeo and Juliet that Penguin published, you had Romeo with stubble and a white tank top and skinny jeans. So they're trying to send the message to teenagers that these books are actually worth reading by making them look like a YA novel.
So even in the age of the ebook and the tablet, the iPad and the other tablets, people are still judging books by their covers?
Maybe teenagers are. I mean, I talked to a bunch of teenagers who said that, you know, they really like the new covers, that they find them much more interesting to look at, and they catch their eye more than, you know, the more traditional covers, which really aren't that appealing. But I also got some opinions. One California 15-year-old I talked to said that she thought that the new versions of these books looked like cheap romance novels. And for her, the thing that she really liked about her copies of Pride and Prejudice was that they were hardcover, they were flowered and very traditional, and they looked like something that was worth reading.
So these are mainly paperbacks then that are being repackaged in this way?
They are. HarperCollins was one of the first publishers to do this in recent memory. In 2009, they introduced some new versions, which people, of course, quipped and said that they looked like Twilight because they had a black cover and like a blooming flower on the front. But a couple of those books actually did quite well. Wuthering Heights sold 125,000 copies in the last couple of years.
In that edition?
In that edition, which is pretty extraordinary. Some of these other newer books have not been on the market very long, so we'll see how the sales do. But, you know, maybe come fall when a lot of schools and libraries start stocking these books and high school kids have reading lists that include the classics, they might turn to these versions.
Now, you mentioned schools and libraries, and that was going to be my next question. Do we know how, say, 10th and 11th grade English teachers or school and public librarians feel about these kind of saucily repackaged classics?
The educators and librarians that I talked to said that they were happy that kids were reading these books. They didn't have a problem with a more sexy, modern cover. They said, you know, whatever it takes for a teenager to open up these books.
Right. It's not tampering with the text at all.
Exactly. I mean, these books are in the public domain, so any publisher can pull them out and repackage them. And, you know, what's inside still remains the same.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Thomas Hart Benton was one of America's most celebrated and admired painters. There's a new biography of him. It's called Thomas Hart Benton, A Life. It's by Justin Wolfe, and it's reviewed for us by the Times' Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic, Holland Cotter, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Holland.
Thank you very much.
Tell us briefly who Thomas Hart Benton was. Some of our listeners will know, but we're going back a little bit in time, and some may have forgotten.
Well, Thomas Hart Benton was a big figure in American art in the 1930s. It was a time when the country was hurting badly and was looking to its own past and history for solace and for self-confirmation. And he was a history painter in an old-fashioned mode, telling that narrative. The big difference was that he was a populist history painter. And I think he was a genuine populist. He grew up in Missouri. His dad was a congressman. He went out stumping with his father as a kid.
Right. He came from a quite prominent family, actually.
They were a prominent family, but they were out. His father was out there on the road a lot, on the farms, in the woods, talking to people. And I think Benton picked up on that at a very early age. He really felt he related to people on a grassroots level.
Now, Holland, this is really difficult to do, but if anybody can do it, you can. Explain some of the attributes of Benton's painting. What gave it this populist flavor and also made it historical? He wasn't painting battle scenes.
No, he was painting, for the most part, contemporary life. But through an interesting filter, he was kind of making it, giving it kind of a symbolic weight. He was drawing on European models for his style, El Greco and Pontormo and various classical painters, and telling an American story through this this interestingly synthetic European-American style.
And landscapes, pastoral visions.
Yep.
How good a painter?
Very good painter. He was, technically speaking, there's no real fault to be found with him.
Why is he not as celebrated today as, say, Edward Hopper, who's something of a contemporary?
I think it's partly to do with politics. I think a lot to do with politics, actually. Hopper's work is remarkable for being hard to put in a period. He's more abstract, I think. He doesn't tell stories, or he just hints at stories. But Benton told real stories that were very much current in the 1930s and still feel like 1930s stories. So he's tied to a period in a way that Hopper's not.
Now, there's another fascinating painter. This will be a leap for our listeners, who's very closely tied in a personal way to Benton, and that's the great Jackson Pollock. Explain that relationship.
Well, Pollock came to New York when Benton was teaching. Benton was at the top of his career when Pollock came to New York in the 1930s. And Benton was teaching at the Art Students League, and that was a natural place for young painters who didn't have much money, and Pollock had none, to go to study. And Benton was a charismatic teacher, a dominant personality, and Pollock was attracted to him. Benton took him under his wing, very much so, took him to his home, introduced him to his family, took him on vacations in the summer. So it was a very personal relationship.
So that means Benton recognized Pollock's talent. Pollock was not painting the, you know, the abstract expressionist canvases we know, but so was he skilled in more traditional technique at this point? How did Benton realize this was an exceptional painter?
Well, Pollock had worked with Mexican muralists, so he was already in that populist vein and history painting vein, and very much along the lines of what Benton was doing. So they had that in common to begin with.
And then Pollock boldly went in an extremely different direction as an artist. And your piece, which I really commend to readers, explains and summarizes in a very elegant way what the differences were in the periods in which the teacher and protege came into their own. What was different about Pollock's period from Benton's?
Well, Pollock was really a post-World War II artist. That's when he came into his own. And very, very different country that at that point.
America was a different
America was a very different country at that point. When Benton was coming up, America was an isolationist mentality. It was looking inward at itself. When Pollock was painting, we were looking to Europe for our models. We wanted to be part of a larger international culture, which America in the 1930s did not want to be.
In fact, some will remember that it was in this period, the Cold War, that as part of the cultural argument America wanted to make about itself, painters like Pollock, who seemed very up-to-date and to have foreign influences, would be shown in museums abroad to prove that America had come of age culturally. Is
exactly.
that right?
Yes, exactly. America was very much trying to position itself as the dominant culture in that time, and we sent our painters to Europe to make that point.
And so what happened then to an artist like Thomas Hart Benton? Did he now seem out of date or provincial? What was the problem there?
He did. He definitely felt out of date and provincial. And he was commissioned then to do work for certain situations, murals for presidential libraries, for town halls, city halls, that sort of thing, government buildings. That still worked. But the larger art world, which had separated itself out at that point as an entity, would have nothing to do with him.
And where is his reputation today?
It's not high. When he is acknowledged, it's often with disdain.
And is that justified?
He's a difficult guy. There's no question about it. But he's part of the story. I think you have to pull him in and recognize that he was very much a formative influence in his time, and remains a part of American art that you can't ignore.
And briefly, how well does Justin Wolfe tell this story?
He tells it very well. Benton was not a lovable figure, and the tendency so far has been to point out what was unlovable about him, including his politics. And Wolfe doesn't do that. He points that out for sure, but he also is willing to see Benton as a conflicted guy and to lay out all those conflicts so that we can see him as a human being.
Thanks so much, Holland.
Thank you.
That's Holland Cotter, who reviews Thomas Hart Benton, A Life, in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, over on the fiction side of things, Janet Ivanovich hits the list at number one, as she generally does these days, with a new book called Wicked Business. It continues a more recent series for Ivanovich about a pastry chef in Salem, Massachusetts.
Right. This is not the Trenton Stephanie Plum series. This is something different.
Right. Exactly right. It's a little bit more playful with like Da Vinci Code type stuff, looking back into history. It's not insignificant that it's set in Salem, Massachusetts.
What else have we got?
At number 13, Terry Pratchett and Stephen Baxter have a multiverse science fiction alternate worlds novel called The Long Earth. And then sneaking onto the list at number 16, Dave Eggers' new novel, A Hologram for the King, which is about an American businessman in Saudi Arabia. And that joins a couple of other solid literary novels on the list. Richard Ford is still there with Canada at number 5. And Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies is in its 7th week on the list at number 15.
That's kind of impressive, actually. True literary authors on the fiction list.
The most impressive thing, I think, is that I've read all three books.
Well, quickly, what's the verdict? You like them all?
Yeah, they're terrific. All three of them are really quality books, yeah.
And Mantel is emerging as a kind of phenom. I see that the Great New York Review of Books is publishing little extracts from the novel.
She kind of invented
a new way of doing historic fiction.
Well, she's an interesting case. She has alternated in her career through doing historical fiction and then through doing more contemporary things. Before she started this Tudor series, Bring Up the Bodies is about Henry VIII and really Thomas Cromwell and the Tudor court. Before she did that, her last book was called Beyond Black. And it was about a modern-day psychic in England who was being besieged by kind of cranky ghosts.
And that's also quite a fine novel, is my understanding. I think Terence Rafferty reviewed that for us.
I think he did. I read that one as well. And yes, it's very funny. She's a sharp writer. Bring Up the Bodies continues the Thomas Cromwell story. It's the downfall of Anne Boleyn. Her previous historical novels, she set some things during the French Revolution and the period just after that. She's very interested in kind of political movements in history and times of great change, which, of course, in the Tudor years is the breaking up of the Catholic hold on politics. And in France, it was the founding of a French empire.
And what about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side of things, Ed Klein's still at number one with The Amateur. So Ed Klein's The Amateur is arguing that President Obama is an amateur. He's kind of too callow and unable to lead. At number 8 this week, we have David Marinus's biography, Barack Obama, hitting the list for the first time at number 8. And that really goes deep into his family background, his childhood, and looking at his formative experiences.
And it's made some waves because he's uncovered a girlfriend and some other aspects of Obama's life that, however well covered we thought was, actually does have some secrets.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about it, it's a very diligently researched book, and it shows a lot of the places where Barack Obama himself maybe glossed over some facts or manufactured some things for the sake of narrative in his memoir, Dreams of My Father, before he was even a senator, which, you know, isn't uncommon in memoir, as we know. But when a memoirist goes on to become such a substantial public figure, journalists have more of an opportunity to dig into that record and find out what the facts really are.
And what else have we got?
At number 10, another political book, it's a memoir called An American Son by the Florida junior senator Marco Rubio.
Talked about as a possible vice presidential candidate, although there are questions being raised now.
Well, he's very young. He's just 41 years old. He's a Cuban American, which some people say would make him appealing to a Latino population if Mitt Romney were to pick him as a vice presidential candidate. He's also very popular among the Tea Party. He's been mentioned a lot along with three or four other people, including Tim Pawlenty.
Rob Portman is another, I think. John Kyle. These are more sort of, you know, white bread white guys.
Yeah, that's right. Paul Ryan is another one of them. But none of them have made the list except for Marco Rubio. He is a rising star in the Republican Party. And then number 11, another political book, Monica Crowley, who's an analyst for Fox News, has a book much more polemic called What the Bleep Just Happened.
That's about President Obama?
It is. It's about the state of the country in general. It's calling for a return to conservative values, for it to hit the list on the day of the Supreme Court's health care ruling. I'll tell you what the bleep just happened.
Well, it's interesting. Monica Crowley began her career as quite an accomplished historian, and her subject was Richard Nixon, with whom she'd worked after his presidential years, has become more of a media personality in recent years.
That's right. She's pretty well regarded, actually, as an analyst, although she has a definite conservative slant. She did work with Nixon, as you mentioned. She wrote a couple of books based on her time with Nixon, still well regarded by historians. She has more substance than somebody like Ann Coulter, although like Coulter, she's an entertainer as much as she is a journalist. And this book is very much, a comic diatribe against liberal values.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.